Welcome to Functional Divorce, your guide to healing and happiness. I'm Dr. Karen Finn. When a couple falls in love and decides to get married, they've got a lot of stuff to get done before they actually say, I do. They need to plan their wedding. Will it be big or intimate or something in between? Well, will they get married in a church, at some fabulous destination, or at the courthouse? Who's going to cater the reception? Who's going to be the photographer? Who's going to be the best man and the maid of honor? Oh yeah, and what about the dress? There are just a million different details involved in planning the wedding. Now, the lovebirds also need to plan their honeymoon and how they're going to begin their life together happily ever after with their goal. Their goal, their ending. Who's all going to be aware of where they're going? Will they be taking the trip of a lifetime, or will they just escape someplace to relax? Or will they skip the honeymoon altogether and just get down to living their lives? There's also one other thing that everyone, well, at least everyone here in the U.S. needs to get, and that's a marriage license. Most people look at a marriage license as just another license that lets the local government get a few bucks. But what most people don't realize is that that marriage license, again, at least here in the U.S., is a legal document. This legal document allows the government, the local, state, and national governments, to essentially view the couple as a newly formed business entity. Yep, you heard me correctly, a business. Now, how unromantic is that? No wonder why nobody thinks about their marriage license besides just another thing to get done when they're planning their wedding. The thing is that the whole idea of viewing the marriage as a business actually allows the courts to more dispassionately look at the situation when a couple decides to divorce. Financially, they view each marriage business as having three components. Assets, which are the property owned by a person or the company, regarded as having value and available to meet the debts, commitments, or legacies. Debts, which are things, typically money, that's owed or due. And then the third component is operating costs, which are basically the expenses related to the operation of the business or just day-to-day life. Now, when former lovebirds call it quits, part of what a divorce decree does is define how the assets, debts, and operating costs of the marriage business are divided. Now, to help us understand more about this division and how to make sure it's quote-unquote fair, I've invited Travis Federick to join us today. Travis is a chartered retirement planning counselor and certified divorce financial analyst with Ameriprise Financial in Southlake, Texas. His career at Ameriprise has spanned 17 years, both as a financial planner helping clients avoid financial pitfalls during divorce, and then to build a plan for them to enjoy a confident retirement. Over the years, he has spoken to numerous groups and corporations and even co-hosted a weekly radio show. He has dedicated his practice to helping people facing divorce make the most informed decisions they can financially. Travis, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much, Karen. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, the first question that I probably really need to ask you is, what is a certified divorce financial analyst?
A certified divorce financial analyst is really someone who can take on two distinct roles in the divorce. In a collaborative divorce, where the parties agree to work together to resolve the end of the marriage, the CDFA works as a neutral third party to assist the divorcing spouses and their attorneys by bringing equitable financial proposals to them to review and hopefully agree upon. In what I call the boxing match divorce, the CDFA stands squarely in the corner of the individual that has hired them and supports them and their attorney throughout the process. Oftentimes, this can save the client a lot of money, as the CDFA's hourly rate is typically lower than that of your normal attorney's rate. And quite frankly, the CDFA has far more expertise in the financial matters of the case than most attorneys do anyways.
So it's pretty much you need to be as specific as you can when you need to ask for help.
I would say that's a fair assessment. Yeah, for sure.
So I'm imagining that these financial proposals that you mentioned in connection with collaborative divorce are different from the ones that you would make when you're actually doing the more combative type of divorce. How are the two different?
Yeah, they are. The collaborative proposals that are put together are it's a resource of all the individuals that are involved in a collaborative case, right? So the two spouses, the two attorneys, myself, and the family therapist or the marital counselor that's involved in the collaborative case. Now, I take information from all of those sources, basically taking the assets from the marriage, the liabilities from the marriage, all the stock, investment accounts, all that stuff together, and create proposals that either equally or unequally divide the assets.
And so that's different from the more boxy match, because then you've only
It's different. It's different from the boxing match proposal, because what I'll do is, like I said, stand in the corner of the client that has hired me to make sure that they receive the amount that they need out of the marriage so that they can move forward, have the right working capital, have the right growing net worth over time, so that, you know, in a situation like one spouse has stayed at home for a significant period of time to raise family, and the other spouse has basically been the working spouse. In that scenario, you know, the spouse that has stayed home, typically it's the wife, you know, statistically speaking, that spouse may need spousal support to get back on their feet, to get back into the workforce, and it may take several years to do that. So I'll have to come up with proposals that favor the spouse that I am representing in the case.
Okay. So some of the things that you mentioned that you look at are the assets of this marital business. What are some of the assets that you typically get involved in helping to divide in a divorce?
Yeah, it's the better question is, what do I not look at? But you know, as far as what gets covered in the divorce settlement, I mean, everything from qualified plans, be it 401ks, IRAs, 403bs, to traditional pension plans, which many of them are gone these days, but there's still some that exist, especially people who have been long-timers at corporations. Profit sharing, employee stock purchase, qualified or non-qualified stock options. There might be a valuation of a privately held business if one of the spouses actually own a business. And there's the marital home, there's rental vacation properties, there's taxable investment accounts, cash value life insurance. You know, and then you got inherited assets. Are they yours? Whose are they? Consumer debt, spousal support, child support, the whole shoot match.
Right. And so do you get involved with things like who gets the kitchen table and who gets the dining room table?
Normally I don't. That's unless there's a serious point of contention because it was some heirloom that was passed down from, you know, family members years and generations ago, then I might need to be involved in that. But you know, typically, and the reason why I say I might need to be involved in that, because it could be a, you know, $50,000 table that they're arguing over. And if that's the case, then we need to maybe shift some of the assets that we're supposed to be to the, you know, the spouse that's getting the table to the other spouse, just to bring it to a more equitable division.
So if it's, you know, just a cardboard table or something, you know, you aren't going to get involved. So
not too much, no.
Well, how do you decide what really is an asset worth getting involved in? I mean, are there any guidelines that people can kind of look at?
gosh, I wish I could say there were guidelines for that. There really aren't. You know, if there's a value assessed to the asset, a tangible value, right? Not necessarily an emotional value, but a tangible value that's assessed to the asset. You know, and one good way to kind of start off, especially if we're talking about property within the home, one good way to start off is to look at the declaration pages of their property and casualty, so their homeowner's insurance. You know, what's covered, what personal property is covered inside there. And it's even better if clients actually go room by room when they do their homeowners and they have that listed. That's a little bit easier for me to help out and divide things. Most of the time, that's already kind of figured out between spouses, and really we're just haggling over investment accounts and stuff like that.
Okay, all right. Yeah, the reason why I bring that up is, you know, there are plenty of stories, and, you know, I've even talked to people who have argued about things like Tupperware lids and video games.
Right.
And, yeah, and, you know, I'll admit, when I got divorced in 2002, we had a spreadsheet of pretty much everything. You know, we just went through everything because neither one of us wanted there to be any harder feelings than there already were, you know, that just kind of naturally come up with the end of a marriage. So I really liked your comment. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I agree. I was divorced 12 and a half years ago, and there was definitely some combativeness between some of the personal items in our home.
Mm-hmm.
So I completely understand that. And my suggestion to folks would be, you know, while you are married and everything's great and happy, and just as you laid it out at the introduction of today's podcast, when everybody smiles and, you know, it's peaches and cream, go through what you've got and, you know, have a discussion of, you know, what if something were to happen. We don't want to think down that path, but if something were to happen, you know, how closely are you tied to grandma's keepsakes, or your great-grandma's keepsakes?
Yeah.
And you know, what would you be willing to give on the other side of that?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's really an interesting discussion, because for a lot of people, you know, thinking about the what if puts them in the mind of, well, maybe.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think especially some of the younger clients that I work with these days, they really kind of have some of those discussions before they walk down the aisle. They talk about stuff like that. I have conversations with them in meetings, and they're like, yeah, we discussed it, and, you know, we're pretty comfortable with it. So,
cool. Excellent. Well, so that kind of gives us a picture of the assets that a marriage business would have, you know, all the stuff that's tangible, that has value, that might be investment accounts, either for retirement or not, inheritance, you know, the boat, the vacation home, all that kind of
right.
Great stuff. But, you know, you also mentioned liabilities, and I said debts. First, let's go into what's the difference between liabilities and debts?
It's very vague, the difference between the two. Liabilities, you know, a liability could be a credit card debt that you have, but again, that kind of falls under the same category. Mortgages, again, are a liability against the house that you have. That's, to me, still a debt. So, for the most part, I view those as one and the same. You know,
okay.
Financially speaking. So, you know, typically when you talk about who handles that in a divorce or who receives that, usually a judge is going to favor the person who has the wherewithal to pay off that debt. So, again, if you've got one spouse that makes $200,000-$300,000 a year in income and the other one doesn't work, well, the one who makes the high income is the one who's probably going to be able to pay that off. So they'll probably lean more towards the debt side going to the spouse that has a higher income.
Okay. Well, that's really good to know, because I've met lots and lots of people over the years who have this great fear that there's too much debt that they can't divorce because they haven't worked and they have
right.
no idea how they pay it off.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay, we've got credit cards, we've got mortgages. What might be some other examples of liabilities that a couple might have?
You know, it could be loans that were taken, student loans that still haven't been repaid. It could be loans that were outstanding to open a business that they started together
mm-hmm.
That still haven't been repaid. Those are typically the bulk of the liabilities that are out there that I've seen. As far as the liabilities ledger goes, those are the bulk.
Okay. Well, one that just popped into my head that I don't really know if it would count as an asset or a debt or a combination is, what about the car?
Well, yeah. Car, assuming it's not been paid off, for sure. Yeah, car.
Okay.
Yeah, and that, the word I'm looking for. The amount that you own the car. The car note
is what's
considered a liability for sure.
Okay. And, you know, if one car has more, it's got more time on the note to be paid off than the other car, would that car also go to the person with more earning capability typically?
Usually, it's really kind of, we're speaking in generalities. Usually, the person who's driving the car is going to take on that debt in the divorce. You know, unless someone's driving a Maserati, and you know, the person driving the Maserati is not the one who makes the income, then we might have to do some creative adjustments there.
Well,
but
that makes a lot of sense, generally speaking.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So then the other thing that I'm aware of, you know, that has to get figured out financially when a couple decides to get divorced, you know, is the operating costs. You know, how much does it cost each of them to live, and how does that get figured out and covered? How does a CDFA or a certified divorce financial analyst view that kind of information?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and that's one that we look at as far as you say operating costs. Like we kind of call it working capital in our lingo, but they're one and the same. And essentially, it's how much does it cost for you to maintain your essential expenses, be able to you know put food on the table, keep the lights on, pay the bills, and then you know what about the lifestyle that you've become accustomed to? Those are components in kind of the division or unequal division of assets in the marriage, and then either be it alimony or spousal support. Spousal support in the state of Texas because we're not an alimony state. But you know, how much should be paid to the spouse that you know, again, raised the kids for 18 years before they went off to college and didn't work, even though they might be degreed and you know can get into the workforce. How much time will it take them to get back in? Those are very important pieces, and you know how much spousal support or alimony should go to that spouse, and for how long, and doing it structuring it in such a way so that taxes are factored into the equation. That's very important.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. What do you mean taxes are figured into the equation?
Well, so alimony is, or spousal support is tax deductible to the person that's paying it and taxable to the person that's receiving it. And so let's go back to the situation of the spouse that make $200,000 to $300,000 a year. Although, you know, he or she might have a distaste for their spouse now because they're going through a difficult divorce process, that they might not want to provide them with, you know, income to support them for, a period of time, it might make financial sense for them to do that to help reduce their taxable income for the year. And a judge would look on that favorably so that, again, the spouse that wasn't in the working in the workforce can go back to work, get whatever training they need to get to kind of move on with their lives and still be able to live a life that they've become somewhat accustomed to.
Right, right. Now, you know, the one thing that we haven't talked at all about with respect to, you know, this working capital idea is kids. I mean, lots of people, when they get divorced, they've got minor kids that they're worried about. How does that play into this picture?
Yeah, so kids is a completely different scenario because obviously you're dealing with child support that we're looking at. And, you know, that's going to be primarily handled by the attorneys through the case, mm-hmm. and state by state, there's different child support guidelines. So depending upon how many kids were born of the marriage, that'll determine what percentage of the net resources for the spouse that's paying, that'll determine how much they have to pay based on the state guidelines. So, but that's part of the equation. And to take a step back, as we talked a minute ago about spousal support, you have to structure it in such a way so that spousal support cannot be reduced by more than $15,000 in the first 3 years. Because if it's reduced by more than that, then that money is considered, in the eyes of the legal system, child support, and the spouse that's paying could be subject to a tax recapture on those dollars if they've already deducted them.
Oh, so it gets kind of squirrely over time. It's not just there's a decree and you're done. There's implications to that decree for a long time.
Oh, for sure. There definitely are.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be working with an astute attorney. And quite frankly, what I would advise anyone to do that feels like divorce is inevitable is, you know, obviously you're going to need an attorney. You can't get divorced. You have to have an attorney to prove up or, you know, sign to have the decree go through the court system. So, but it's just as imperative that you find a certified divorce financial analyst in your area so that you have somebody that's looking out for your financial best interest through the process. And as soon as you have an inkling that the marriage can't be saved.
Right, right. Well, you know, one of the things that I hear people talk about when they talk about their divorce settlement is they want it to be fair. You know, like, what's fair to them is probably not fair to their soon-to-be ex, you know? And so I'm wondering, from just the financial standpoint that you work with, what are the, you know, two or three key items that you say are required to make a divorce settlement fair?
So that's a very good question as well. And if I can start by saying, I think fair is a relative term overall. Mm-hmm. If we're not talking the financial aspect, fair is a relative term. I think if both spouses feel that they've gotten what they want out of the settlement, then it's a fair settlement.
Right.
From a CDFA's perspective, a fair settlement is one in which both spouses can walk away really knowing that their financial future has not been mortgaged by the fact that their marriage is over. Their respective cash flows, their net worths are positive and projected to grow over time. But from a fair perspective, dollar and cents wise, I would say that you have to look at the tax implications of a divorce is most important. So for instance, if I'm working with a client who's got $200,000 in taxable accounts, and they've got, you know, $200,000 in tax-deferred accounts, 401ks or IRAs or something like that, it might seem very simple for one spouse to say, you know what, you take the non-qualified assets and I'll take the IRAs, or you take the IRAs and I'll take the non-qualified assets. Well, there's different tax implications to both of those. The IRAs have never been taxed at all, and they're fully taxable when money is distributed. And depending upon what the tax rates are when you take money out, you know, if I've got $200,000 in there and tax rates are 30%, well, there goes $60,000 of those assets. Tax rates are lower on non-qualified accounts, so that might not be a fair division, even though on paper it looks like it.
Great. So tax implications are huge with any settlement.
For sure.
So what's another key item that you think our listeners need to know in order to determine whether or not, from a financial standpoint, their settlement is really quote-unquote fair?
Yeah, I think the other big one is pension assets. What I found in working with clients that have pensions, you know, clients who've been working for a corporation for 25, 30 years and they have the traditional pension plan that says at retirement, you know, we're going to pay you $3,500 a month or $4,000 a month. Well, as a married couple or a spouse who was married to that individual who worked for the company for 25, 30 years, that spouse may have been married to that person for 20 of the 25 years that they were working for that individual, or working for that corporation, sorry. And if that is the case, they have a right or an entitlement to receive a portion of that pension. A lot of times that gets really swept under the rug and doesn't get caught by attorneys who aren't using a CDFA in the case.
Right.
So that's something that I think is pretty critical. The other thing that's critical is the ability to take money out of a qualified retirement plan during the divorce process, assuming there's a quadro involved, a qualified domestic relations order. You can take money out of a retirement plan even if you're under 59 and a half and you don't pay a 10% penalty during that time. It has to be done during that time, and a lot of times spouses aren't aware of that. They don't think about that until it's too late.
What I really think is fascinating about your answer, Travis, with respect to this fair question, is that it's all long-term thinking. You know, it's all about the retirement and those assets that have been put away planning for the future. It's not about the immediate, you know, who gets which car, who gets the house, any of that stuff. It's all keeping the long-range plan in mind. And I find that especially important because so many people, when they're getting divorced, get tied up in the drama and the trauma and the emotions of the event. And they forget, because it's really hard when you're going through that, that life's going to go on.
Yeah,
and
I couldn't agree with you more.
To their future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about that. It's a, you know, I always tell clients that financial planning is a one-time event. It's a point-in-time event. It, you know, we look at financial planning long-term, but when we bring it down to the nuts and bolts, it's here's where you stand today, and then we try and plan towards the goals. The divorce event, it's, you know, for some people it's more than a one-time event, but what we're assuming is that it's a one-time event for these two individuals, certainly these two individuals together. And yes, it's extremely emotional. You know, everybody who's been through it knows all about the divorce 15. I know I lost mine pretty easily.
Yeah,
we're talking about 15 pounds. Yeah. So it's really hard to get past the bitterness that you're feeling now. But to your point, Aaron, if you can be grounded by an objective third party, be it a financial planner, be it your attorney, be it a family member or a counselor or what have you, to say, look, you know, at some point this is going to be over and you got to move on. It's pretty important to keep the long-term picture in mind.
Yeah, I love that. And unfortunately, on that note, we're out of time. I have thoroughly enjoyed talking to you today, Travis, and I hope that our listeners have really gotten a good idea for how a certified divorce financial analyst can make a huge difference in the quote-unquote fairness of their divorce settlement.
Well, I've enjoyed it, too. I appreciate
you
having me on.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. Everyone, I've been talking with Travis Federick, Chartered Retirement Planning Counselor and Certified Divorce Financial Analyst with Ameriprise Financial in Southlake, Texas. If you'd like to learn more about Travis and his services, you can reach him at 817-722-2464.